Good evening, everyone. I hope everyone is doing well tonight. My name is Linda, 34. Okay. So just a quick update for those who may be new to the center or new to this tradition. If you've normally come on a Sunday and Geshe Gelik is here, Geshe Gelik likes for us to prostrate with him, so that's kind of our normal, way of doing things. Tonight and during Venerable Rabina's time with us, we're going to change things up a little bit. So once Venerable Rabina arrives, she will come through the door here. And as she comes in, we will all stand. And then it's completely optional. Well, first of all, she'll come on in and do prostrations. And then she'll go ahead and get seated. And once Venerable Rabina is seated, then it's completely optional if you would like to do some prostrations. The prostrations are simply to kind of show respect for the Buddha's teachings. So again, that's an optional practice if you feel comfortable doing it or not. And then I did also want to mention that with Venerable Rabina, she brought a couple different things. One is a devotion CD that was playing, actually, so some of you got to hear that. And that's an item that's for sale. And I did want to mention that just inside the cover are the words to the chants that are being sung on the CD. So it's quite lovely. And those are available just outside in the bookstore area for purchase. And then also the Chasing Buddha movie. So both of these things are available if that's something that you're interested in. And what? And the book. And she has mentioned this several times, the book Mahamudra, How to Discover Our True Nature by Lama Yeshe. So that, too, is available in the bookstore. Also, when she comes in, we have been starting the evening with the refuge prayer in Tibetan. Okay, and that is found in the Gold Prayer Book on page 34 if you want to join in on that prayer as well. So, and the dedication's on what? 36? 36. Thank you, Joe. Anything else that I'm missing? Okay, so hold tight. She should arrive shortly. Thanks.
So here we are, put together for a little bit. Let's make the most of our time. Think, analyze, contemplate, internalize these words, words coming from the Buddhist approach to life. And the way to listen is as advice. You don't have to, I always insist, I say it this way, it's important, because it's religion, we tend to think I'm supposed to believe everything I hear. No, on the contrary, Buddha says, don't believe a single word I'm telling you. Listen to it, think about it, and if you want to take it on board as advice, that's your decision. I joke, but I'm serious, we can be a 1% Buddhist, you can take what works for you. We are the boss here, absolutely. So this advice always is how to help us become less neurotic, less fearful, less depressed, more kind, more wise, more content for our sake and the sake of others. That's the bottom line. So we'll sing a little prayer that expresses this as our motivation.
Sangye charang soke chok nam la Jangsho badu dagni khyab su chi Dagi chan yen gi pe sonam ki Drona penche sangye drubha shok Sangye charang soke chok nam la Jangsho badu dagni khyab su chi Dagi chan yen gi pe sonam ki Drona penche sangye drubha shok Sangye charang soke chok nam la chang chu baju dagni khyab su chi dagi chan yen gi pa sonam ki drola penche sangye drupa shog.
So I think I saw in the title tonight something about being content. It's kind of like a boring word, really, isn't it? It's kind of, oh, content. Who wants content? We want happy, exciting, joyful pleasure, but content, not so sure, you know? But it's one way of really framing, you know, the Buddhist approach. Yeah, essentially, you know, Buddha's expertise is the human mind. That might be a surprise to us, because we tend to think of religion as not the mind. We think of that as psychology, and then spiritual is the spirit or the soul. But it all comes down to the same thing, doesn't it, you know? And certainly in Buddhism, I mean, they don't use the word soul, they don't use the word spirit. Buddha talks about the mind. He didn't say the word psychology, because they didn't know Greek there. It's only us lately have, you know, taken all these Greek words and used them. All our fancy words are Greek. But they didn't, you know, he talked about the mind. That's always ever what the Buddhists talked about, is the mind for 2,500 years. The mind. So what's the mind? The mind is our thoughts and feelings and emotions, isn't it, you know? So the bottom line for the Buddha, very simple. I mean, it goes to incredible depth in the literature and the analysis and the practice. It takes a long time to accomplish. But the concept is really simple. And it sounds very encouraging. The Buddha's view, coming from his own experience, is not revelation. It's coming from his own direct experience internally, from investigating his own mind deeply internally. He has found that all these unhappy states of mind that we are intimately familiar with, you know, and forget all the fancy words we use in modern psychology, just simple words, anger, anxiety, depression, low self-esteem, you know, dissatisfaction, always wanting something more, all of this, these simple, simple words, depression, these simple words, we recognize them profoundly and deeply. And in fact, they're so normal for us that they seem to dominate us sometimes, even though we're nice people and don't go around killing and lying and stealing from too many people, you know. But somehow these thoughts are in there all the time. They're very easy to activate. They seem to be lying quietly underneath all the time and very often come to the surface very easily. A small argument with your sister, something goes wrong at work, and up come these unhappy thoughts. Up come all these confused, unhappy thoughts, you know. So this, we take this stuff for granted. We assume, we give it equal status along with the other parts of our mind. Love and kindness and generosity and joy and happiness and forgiveness and patience. Words that we know we also recognize and which we kind of know are the nice stuff. I mean, you check, if you're on the receiving end of somebody else's depression, anxiety, anger, jealousy, low self-esteem, it's horrible. And if you're on the receiving end of someone else's kindness, love, compassion and patience, it's fantastic. This should tell us something, you know. We recognize the same things in ourselves. We know the nice ones and we know the unhappy ones. But unfortunately, we've got these really kind of unhappy views about, these difficult views about these unhappy ones. So Buddha's view, Buddha's fundamental point, and this is really serious in Buddha psychology, and it's described in great depth, and when we can begin to get some confidence in this, it's very compelling. That this unhappy stuff is not at the core of our being. I mean, it's a big surprise. We think it is. We really believe it is. We don't need some psychologist to tell us that. The neuroscientists will tell us it is. And all our psychological models of the mind in our culture all act from the assumption that a normal person has some anxiety, some jealousy, some depression, some anger, some love, some compassion, some intelligence, and we hope that we have some kind of balance of these. This is, I think, the view that we take as a given. I don't think I've ever heard of any views in modern psychology that would suggest that you can get rid of completely all the unhappy stuff. But this is exactly what Buddha's saying, and has been. I mean, it hasn't changed in 2,500 years. This is what Buddha's been saying for 2,500 years. This is the very basis of Buddhist psychology and therefore Buddhist practice. So that's quite a radical thing to say. For a psychologist to suddenly pop up and write a report in a psychological magazine tomorrow that they've decided that anger and jealousy aren't at the core of our being and we can get rid of them, they have got to have done a lot of research to try and prove this point. You can't just say it. Well, Buddha's proved his point. It's all there. We have to study it, that's all. It's all there. He's not forcing it upon us. Yeah, but it's all there for us. And that's what we become involved in as we, if we take on board, if we decide ourselves to be a Buddhist. This is the bottom line, you know, for being a Buddhist. You can look there looking very nice, like a 14th century nun like I am, in these clothing, and have a bald head, and sing prayers, and do mantras, and do religious type things. That's fine. But the essence of being a Buddhist is working, is knowing your mind. Is basically, even if we can't conceptualize, even if we can't imagine a person who has no fear, no anger, no ego, no jealousy, no depression, no anxiety. I mean, that sounds pretty abstract to us. I know recently in one course, one woman who'd heard this for the first time, just very correct what she said. She said, but that's ridiculous. What are you talking about? What kind of person is that? I mean, we can't imagine a person. Try and think about it. Think about it. Do we know anybody who never has any problems, who really is always joyful, always clear, always wise, always happy, always compassionate, always empathetic with everybody, never has a moment of being down? No, I don't think we do. So, of course, we can be forgiven for thinking that this stuff is at the core of our being. So there's Buddha telling us that his view is, from his own experience, that it's not. Well, either we just think he's ridiculous and close the book and go somewhere else, or we take him seriously. And my sense is it's pretty outrageous. And if there is evidence from this, and that's all in the Buddhist literature, that's pretty tasty. My goodness. But my feeling is, even if you can't quite get your head around the idea that you can get rid of all of it, and the fact is it'll take you time, so don't hold your breath, that's long term, but even that indicates already that it's not set in stone, that we can maybe even simply lessen it. I mean, that's pretty tasty. That's pretty exciting already, you know. So how do I understand that? Practically. Well, the way to understand it is, and this takes time, first of all, when we say those words like attachment and anger and jealousy and depression and anxiety, we immediately use the word emotions, feelings, emotions. And that's when they're very, you know, they're strong. You know, that's a strong experience, isn't it? And that usually means your body is very involved. Look at a person who's angry. It's evident by seeing their body. They shout, they yell, their eyes are wide, the mouth is, you know, irrational words coming out their mouth. You know, they're having a mental breakdown, basically. We just go, oh, look at him, she's angry, you know, look at her, she's angry. So that's what we call feelings. Now, to say, then, when you, let's say you have, like one of us a couple of nights ago talked about how she can't stop saying bad things to her husband. We see how hard it is to control our mouth. Forget punching and killing and shouting and yelling. Just to control the mouth in one day seems almost impossible, doesn't it? Because we have certain feelings, we're not paying attention, and out they pour. And suddenly you go, oh, wow, that's interesting, I must be angry. You only realize after the words came out the mouth. And that's part of our problem. But the point is, that is part of the problem. That's a major part of the problem, which indicates the real point, that we don't know how to notice what is going on in our mind until it becomes emotional. We've been talking the last few days. So this is a stumbling block. This is a big stumbling block. And why is that? Because it's, generally speaking, with respect to our culture, not part of our education. We're brilliant at, you know, education in terms of the intellect. Artistic, creative, scientific. We're incredible. Our education is ingenious. But we don't seem to have, I mean, you know, we don't have any approach that enables us to pay attention to what we're thinking and feeling. And that's really the Buddhist approach. That is the Buddhist approach. And it's not anything cosmic, I promise. It's just practical. Don't think of it as holy. That's absurd. I mean, we all know we've got thoughts all the time. Look at from the time you wake up until the time to go to sleep. And look when you can't go to sleep one night. You mightn't have been that very distressed during the day, but you just can't go to sleep. We really do think we're going crazy, don't we? I mean, this endless, just piling upon each other, and there's like a train running in our head, and there's no way in the universe we can stop it. We are very familiar with that. So, of course, in our culture, we think, oh, that's normal. Uncontrolled thoughts. That's just the way unconscious is, you know, that's how it is, you know. But the Buddhist approach is, it's like mental illness. His view is, and this is what's coming from India, these thousands of years before even the Buddha, they've invented this technique that we know vaguely these days as mindfulness meditation. It's just this practical skill and it's really simply called concentration. It's a practical technique where you learn to focus your mind in order to control it from not following every thought. In the beginning, you just think your mind's getting worse because you hear more and more crazy thoughts, so you don't hold your breath and think it's going to change overnight. But the Buddhist approach is we have got the potential to really harness the energy of our uncontrolled thoughts. And, I mean, that's not going to happen overnight either, I promise you. But it's pretty intense, it's pretty tasty that someone has that view. But our point in the West, of course, is we mainly emphasize the physical thing called the brain. We know we've got the thoughts and feelings, and whether you even know you have a brain or not, we don't have to be told we have lots of thoughts and feelings. I mean, I don't care if you think, like I say, I don't mind if you think your mind is in your toenail. If you have never heard of a brain, you don't need to be told you've got a brain to know that you've got thoughts. So, you know, and the thoughts are what Buddha's concern are. That's his concern. How to learn to listen to, become, learn techniques to become, to learn to harness. Not make all the thoughts go away. That'll come eventually, long term, as we really advance. But that's Buddha's expertise. It's nothing kind of mystical. It's extremely practical. And surely something we would all love to be able to do. So the point is that when I'm saying the words thoughts here, I didn't say the words feelings. So this is a really crucial point in Buddhism. Feelings, like I said, we say feelings when it's a very strong emotion. Feeling necessarily is an emotion for us, and that is when the body is involved. Either you're crying, or you're very happy, or you're laughing, or you're very joyful, you're very compassionate, there are tears, you're very angry, you're anxious, so your heart's beating fast. It's always the body involved. And what that indicates is that we don't notice what is going on in our mind until it becomes emotional. Because you see, the Buddha's view about the mind, we tend to think mind is here and emotions are here. Well, for the Buddha, this is all mind. This is all mind. And the emotions, where the physical body's involved, are just the physical expression of what's deeper down, actually elaborate conceptual thoughts. In other words, it's not that complicated to prove that. Let's just say you tape record. I used this example for a long time. It's very obvious. Let's say not tape record these days, it's old-fashioned. Let's say you have your MP3 player, where you put your iPhone on, and you record someone having an angry fit. You simply record their words, and then you transcribe their words accurately with all the exclamation marks and the dot, dot, dots and the dashes, you know, do you understand? Because you can, and so when anybody, so if you read that piece of paper, you don't need to hear shouting to go, wow, this person's angry. How do you know? By the words. What are words? Words are thoughts. This is a simple but profound point. We're so addicted to seeing emotion as physical, and then when you see a person who's quiet, or they're fairly quiet, they're fairly controlled, they're fairly disciplined, they don't have much emotion, we'll say. But that person might have the most fierce, outrageous thoughts, but they don't express them. That's really common. You ask that person to write down their angry thoughts, and if you compared those two bits of paper, maybe the quiet person's thoughts are more shocking, more angry, more violent. I can think of at least two of the fairly recent, you know, serial killers. One kid, and the one guy who did in that concert from the hotel room. Where was that? That one. Everybody who knew this, they said nobody could find any evidence of any description in his computer, in his behavior, in anything, in all his life, that he had anger. Now, excuse me, if you want to kill with multiple machine guns many people, I would suggest it's coming from anger. I mean, excuse me, like it's not coming from love, sorry. It's really simple. Don't make it, we make it so complicated in the West, you know? They went as far back as they could. His brother said he still is speechless with shock. If anyone in the family, he was the last one to think. you know. And there was one of the kids who was always just considered, another kid, a serial killer, who was just considered quiet. Oh, he's just quiet. So we have quiet people. We don't pay attention to them. But if they're ranting and raging and going on, then we get nervous. But just because they're quiet, we don't care. Whatever, as long as they behave well, it's okay by us. Because we have no idea what goes on in people's minds. We don't pay attention until it comes out the mouth, until they shout and yell. And that's the thing with ourselves. We don't know what's going on in our mind until it comes out the mouth either. Because why? It's very simple, because we don't pay attention. We don't go there. From the second we wake up until we go to sleep, where is our attention? Out there. All the time. Out there. It's not kind of religious. It's not part of our deal, not part of our education to pay attention to all our thoughts. We all just think, well, we're born this way, what to do, you know. And then we get to the level where it's strong emotions, then it's a bit late. It's like it's already the Vesuvius is exploding. So the Buddha's practical point is, if we can learn, you know, as soon as we can in our lives, don't wait till, you know, you go crazy when you're 25 or 50, start when you're little, with simple techniques to help you become familiar, to even notice. Guess what? There are thoughts going on there, babe. And then even more than that, even more intelligent, learn to recognize the thoughts. Well, eventually, wow, that's angry thoughts, that's jealous thoughts, that's depressed thoughts, that's anxious thoughts, that's loving thoughts, that's kind thoughts. But the trouble is, when we do even pay attention, they're all raging on 1,000 thoughts a second, and that's a Western scientific view, 1,000 thoughts a second. Buddha agrees with that. We can't even keep up with our own thoughts, there's so many. And it's just like this sound, isn't it? Like this noise inside our head while we're busy doing things. And it's only when they rise to the surface as emotions, we then notice. So we just notice a tiny percentage and we notice the tip of the iceberg. So it's practical. If all those emotions are not coming from anywhere, not coming from nowhere, they're not coming from outside, we believe they are, we believe they come from the boyfriend. We believe I'm a nice person and then he makes me angry. No. No, he might be a nice boyfriend and he might be not a nice boyfriend, you know, but you've got some anger inside there. But we have to see them before they get to the emotional level, and that's at the conceptual level. This is not complicated. This is not, but it's a radical way to see the mind. You know, there's a type of therapy that's called, what is it called?
Dialectical behavior therapy.
What's the word? I suddenly forgot. What?
Dialectical behavior therapy.
Not that one, another word. There's new ones every day. Cognitive therapy. You're changing your thoughts. But the Buddha's view of what thoughts are, and this is what's fascinating, because Buddha's view, this technique in Buddhism of single point of concentration, which the world knows as mindfulness, if we really did that sincerely, you'd get to a subtler, you'd be able to access a subtler level of your own mind itself, which we don't even posit as existing in our culture. And there you would hear loud and clear these thousands of thoughts. But because the mind is more focused, we can pay more attention. And so that's what we have to learn to do. We have to learn to pay attention to what's going on in our mind before it vomits out the mouth, before you can't be out of bed one morning inert from depression. It's just too late to wait till then. That's the key point. But of course it takes effort to do it. It seems kind of boring, you know, because as soon as we wake up, we've got to jump into breakfast and the kids and this and the job. We're just full on in activity, you know. But even give us 5 minutes just to focus on our boring old breath, to anchor our attention to the breath, to train ourselves, to at least begin to pay attention. So, okay, then this, where's this contentment word fit in, you know? Buddha's very distinct approach to the mind, he divides the positive states of mind, he divides into two categories, the main contents of our mind. The positive, reasonable, useful, beneficial, empathetic, altruistic, connected to others, thoughts and emotions. The stuff that when that's prevailing in our lives, we're happy and our friends are happy. It's really that simple. And then there's the other stuff. When that is prevailing, that's when the nightmares are. The bad conversations, the unhappiness, the fights, the arguments, the fears, the dramas, and that stuff, you know, and because we've never paid attention to our mind, and because it's not part of our culture to learn to even distinguish in this seemingly simplistic way between these two categories of the contents of our mind, then we just follow our nature, we just follow our feelings, you know. And if you happen to be a person who's born with patience and kindness and forgiveness, then you'll be okay in your life. If you happen to be a person born with lots of attachment and dissatisfaction and anger, getting angry easily and lots of anxiety, then it'll be a drama. But we don't think we have much control over it, because we mainly think it's coming from there. That's the biggest major problem. But if we can even begin to have the courage to own that this is my mind, and it's my bunch of habits, and I better learn to know them and start to take control of them and work with them and harness them, already from even that thought, that's profound, you know. So in the Buddha's analysis of all these unhappy states of mind, like I mentioned before, in all the texts, they talk about something like Buddha came up with, honestly, a list of 84,000 distinct different mental problems. I don't think even Western psychiatric volumes have caught up with that yet. 84,000 distinct ones. But fortunately, they're all subsumed to three. Thank goodness. And these are the three, as you know in the text, they call them the three poisons, but how about we call them the three toxic emotions? It's a very current term. They seem simple enough, but if we really can begin to comprehend these in the way Buddhist psychology presents them, which is in great depth, this will give us a sound basis for understanding our own selves quite deeply, and indeed, therefore, understanding everybody else. Because Buddha says we're all made of the same kind of components, but just different recipes of them. You know, different amounts. You know. So these three, in fact, the two really are the day-to-day ones. Forget even the main one. The main one is known colloquially as ego grasping. And at some point, one of our days, we'll surely talk about that. But the two that I want to talk about, and we've been doing it all the week, and here's particularly relevant, is the first one is attachment, and then the second one is anger. And these seem so simplistic, I can't believe. They seem so boring, you know. So, but the Buddhist understanding was quite profound, I must say. I must suggest. And that's for us to find out. So, attachment is like the default that is for the Buddha, and this is stated in the Four Noble Truths, is the main cause of our suffering day to day. Now, that sounds beyond shocking to us. The word attachment is not even a word we often use in our daily lives if we're not Buddhists. Occasionally, we might use a word called attachment, and it usually is meaning you've got a close connection with somebody, so we see it as a nice thing, and that's perfectly fine. But when Buddha uses the word attachment, he's got another definition, and we really have to use his definition if we want to understand him. But we often forget that, you know, we use our definition. But we know that same words can have different definitions. I always think, you know, a silly example, when I was brought up as a kid and lived in Australia and then went to London, we lived in flats, you know. But of course we're all Americanized now, we all live in apartments. You didn't know that because you're American, but I'm telling you, Australians and English people now live in apartments because of American movies. Of course, that's fair enough, nothing wrong. But we live in a flat. Now imagine if I'd only ever heard that word as a place where you live, and then suddenly I learn geometry and I learn that that's flat. I'll go, oh, you mean I've got to live there? No, it's another definition, Rabina, come on. The same word, same spelling, same sound, two separate meanings. Same here with attachment. So don't even begin to think of the meaning we use, which is close to people, or she's just attached to her family. That's a wonderful quality. That's not how Buddha's talking. It's like an awful state of mind. It's one that breaks our heart, and it's the basis, the Buddha says, of anger and all the other dramas. That's kind of shocking to hear that. So let's look at it. What is it? Well, this is what's an interesting point. The most fundamental, energetic, primordial level of it that we're born with is called dissatisfaction. The opposite to content. It's really like the half glass full. Half empty, isn't it? Glass half empty. So when people have got, we've all got it to some degree, Buddha says. As long as you're an ordinary person, you've got this attachment, especially you've got dissatisfaction. But we can all see with some of us, we have it, some people have it seriously. And it's really, you can see it's real suffering. No matter what you get, never enough. No matter what you hear, never enough. No matter what you achieve, never enough. No matter what you have, never enough. No matter what you accomplish, never enough. No matter how much your boyfriend tells you, it's never enough. I mean, that is exhausting. dissatisfaction, always seeing the bad things, always about yourself, especially always seeing what you haven't done, what you haven't achieved. We are addicted to this one. This is beyond tragic, I tell you. And this is the point. You know, we know this one. This is just this first level of dissatisfaction, of attachment. I'm going to go to the other soon. There's other aspects of it. This is the first one, the most fundamental, the most primordial. But you look how we are. We've all got this one nakedly. You know, like talking to a friend of mine recently who's got lots of jobs to do. And every now and again, we all know we've got too many jobs, you panic. And all you do is think about all the jobs you haven't done. You think about all the things you've got to do and you have a panic attack. So, you know, the way to do, for me, you look at each project and then you break it down into details. And then, you know, you can look at one project and you can see. So she said, you know, all these things she has to do, she's got to finish this piece and that and this, and it's a disaster, it's that, and I've got to do this and this. I said, I understand, but how about shining a different light on it? Let's see what you have done. You achieved that piece, you achieved this piece, you achieved that piece. So in general, it is moving forward. No, 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 she said. All I can see is all she could see was the things she hadn't done. But it's just as valid to shine another light on it and say, what about this and this? But when we're caught in that disease, we just can't see it. And that's how we are with people. People will tell us, we all look in the mirror, we see a fat, ugly person. We all look in the mirror, we see the wrong size ear, the wrong shape nose, we wish we had fixed this. Everybody, in one degree or another, we always see what we think we aren't. We find fault in especially our bodies, the thing we see every day. This is just universal, and this is the irony of the energy of attachment. Already we are dissatisfied. Dissatisfied. And the tragedy is, it is a conceptual story that our mind runs to, and we believe it is true. We believe it is true. We believe it. That's the killer. That's the one that destroys us. And all the neuroses are the same. So this is like anger. It's really just like aversion to yourself. It's like anger to yourself in a way. This dissatisfaction, it's a function of attachment. It's the bottom energy of attachment. And because then what it gives rise to is, well, I'm not enough as I am, so I have to look for something. So we look out there. Where do we look? Where does attachment look? The five sense objects. If I get that, I'll get happy. If I get that, I'll do. If I change this, I'll be okay. If I get this one, if I do that one, if I fix this one, if I have this one, then I'll be okay. Then it'll be all right. But we all know when you do that one, you still won't be happy. So when you hear the extreme absurd examples like this, and we all laugh, I remember one of those television programs, you know, where people with their extreme habits, and one little girl, I mean, she was like little. She was little, a woman, a little, little woman. But she was obsessed only on her body, the only thing she thought of was her breasts. And she had like, and I'm not joking now, she had countless procedures. Every time she got another enhancement, she wasn't happy. She wanted it bigger. There's nobody in this country will give her one now. She's been to Mexico. No one there will give her one. Her breasts are like triple Z or something. I mean, I'm not even trying to be funny, you know? Yeah, I mean, we can laugh at it, but that's a kind of like an exaggerated example of how we all are. Dissatisfaction. No matter what we get, if for a while we might be okay, but then it fades, so we want a new one. Well, you know, but immediately with her, almost the second she got a new enhancement, it was never enough. She talked about it. She said they're her friends. All she does is talk about her breasts like these, and there's nothing, and like, it's clearly agony to have these breasts in her little body, you know. This is a bizarre example of the suffering of dissatisfaction. And we run to it automatically, and we see it as the absolute truth. Even when someone says, Rabina, you're really a nice person, you've got a very nice this and a very nice that, and we all know that with each other. We can all see our friend. We hear our friend say how fat they are, and we look at them. We think, well, you know, you could maybe lose a pound, but you're okay as you are. But no, we are addicted. We are addicted to believing I'm not enough. We ought to be in tears of compassion for ourselves every day, but we recognize it. This is the energy of attachment. Then naturally it gives rise to the next level, which is the hunger after something, thinking now it'll be okay when I get that. So of course you have the classic examples, and again the cliched examples. If it's not the breast example, it's the eating too much food example. One other little girl, you can tell she was little, but she's like 500 pounds. You could see it in her face. And that's what junkie is. She's a junkie for food. And her mother, the way she said it was so sweet. Her mother said, oh, she's always been like this. She never felt full. And that's so moving. Meaning, feeling full, we conflate that. I remember since a little child, I'm attached to my food. I understand it. We conflate feeling full with being satisfied. But satisfaction's mental. So clearly in her case, this deepest dissatisfaction, I'm like empty. So then her attachment went to her food. And she got to 500 pounds. But she never felt full. I mean, when we analyze these states of mind, we can recognize them deeply. This is all in Buddhist psychology. And then we can make this our own real experience by recognizing it's true. And this is a primordially deep mental illness, Buddhism calls these. They don't use that term. It's very fascinating. The word they use in India, Indian literature, thousands of years before, I mean, you know, it went to Tibet 1,200 years ago. Before that, in India, the term for these unhappy states of mind is the word affliction. You'll see it in all the Buddhist literature, won't you? Look at His Holiness saying it, and Madame Geshe-la says it. Affliction. Well, in my mind, it's a very antiquated word, so I don't use it. But look at it. What's an affliction? Affliction means a problem, an illness, a difficulty, an illness. Well, what kind of affliction? A mental problem, a mental illness. But that phrase is so powerful for us, it's too shocking to hear, that we've got mental illnesses. It's only the people down the other end of the spectrum who've got mental illnesses, isn't it? Do you see what I'm saying? Because we use that term very powerfully. But that's a technical phrase that is an accurate translation of affliction. The Indian word, the Buddha's word for these unhappy states of mind. They're mental, and they're illnesses. I mean, if that dissatisfaction is not a mental illness, I don't know what it is. Is it a happiness? I don't think so. We believe it's true. We haven't got enough. We believe it's true. We're not nice enough. We believe it's true. We have not educated enough. We believe it's true. You name it, you've got a story, and you know it's not enough. Every one of us on the planet, this is the suffering. Buddha calls this samsara. He calls this the suffering of samsara. This is his word for it. To make it religious, we recognize it. And this is Buddha's expertise. We so take this for granted in our culture, in our psychology. We don't even name it, really. It's only when you're a serious, like, you know, triple Z breasts and 600 pounds and a junkie, then we think, wow, you've got a problem with attachment. No, having any attachment whatsoever, you've got a problem, Buddha says. And all he is saying is, you know what, babes, you can learn to work with this and lessen it. And long-term, even get rid of it. And what's the result of that? Literally, utter contentment, which means bliss. In Lama Yeshe's book, Mahamudra, which I really recommend, okay? Not because I edited it. But because I know the teaching well, because I edited it, yes. But not because of me, I'm not being arrogant. But because it's just such an amazing teaching. And in there, because it's a more advanced practice, but Lama's talking about in the way they talk about the nature of mind in Buddhism. This is unknown in our culture. We don't talk like this, because we talk about a brain. What do you mean, our true nature? Your brain is a bunch of yucky stuff, you know? Isn't it? That's how we talk. But the way the Buddhists talk, because of this extraordinary insight into the workings of the human mind beyond the brain, it's just they've discovered, these amazing beings over the centuries since the Buddha, and countless beings have accomplished this since the Buddha, that when we rid the mind of even to some degree of these neuroses, what is our mind like? Naturally joyful. Naturally happy. Please hear the word simply. I mean, Lama talks about it in here. There's a chapter on how you would be if you had accomplished single point of concentration. This amazing technique that's in it. It's still extant, real, living technique that people today and people looking like us, like modern people, are doing and accomplishing. Nothing like it in our culture. Nothing like it in our psychology. And it's coming from these Indians several thousand years before the Buddha. So it's several thousand years old, and it's still a living, real technique that you, if you really worked hard, you can go and get it in two or three years. Well, I mean, to do it, you've got to be pretty qualified already. You've got to give up sex, drugs, and rock and roll, give up your family, your mortgages, your children, your food, your this. Not your food, but attachment to food, attachment to clothing, attachment to reputation, and go off for a couple of years, and you'll get it. I promise. Hard work, but it's possible. How your mind would be then, we can't even imagine it. Well, I mean, forget even the more cosmic qualities, but you would be crystal clear, a state of mind that we would rarely even touch upon. Your mind would have, you'd have effortless control over every shiny thought. Effortless control. You'd have extraordinary wisdom. You'd have clairvoyance. I mean, that's just normal for the Buddha. That's a normal state of mind that we can all accomplish, because Buddha's talking about a subtler state of mind. But you'd be blissfully clear and joyful all the time. I mean, that seems a bit hysterical to us, because when we think of joy, we think of kind of hysterical. You know? Even when we say the word pleasure, it sounds a bit naughty, like a sin, doesn't it? But this is the Buddha's point. The nature of our mind, to the degree it is unencumbered by attachment, neediness, depression, anxiety, jealousy, anger, all of which come from this dissatisfaction, the natural state of our mind, to the extent that it's unencumbered by that stuff, is to be joyful. Naturally. This is a powerful point the Buddha's making, and it's hard for us to hear this. Because why? Because our view of happiness, our view of what happiness is what we get when attachment gets what it wants. But Buddha says, no, happiness is what we get when we give up attachment, even to some degree. So it's a pretty interesting concept. And it's all internal, and we can do it, and it's free. It's just hard work, that's all. It's the hardest job we'll ever do. But it's deeply described in all the literature. But often because we read it, and it's all Tibetan, and it seems medieval, and it's packed with so many other concepts, we can't get to the essence of it. You know, it's quite hard for us. And that's understandable. But this is the point the Buddha's coming to. This is our true nature, to be blissful and clear. Our true nature, finally, to be a Buddha, but forget that. So dissatisfaction is the first level of attachment. It says, from the practice, the Buddha says, of past lives, of always wanting something more, always wanting something more, never being satisfied. So we come into this aching disease of dissatisfaction, and then we're hungry for something more because we think we're missing something, and so then we keep eating something more and drinking something more and having something more and seeing it and tasting and touching it and smelling it, and then it lasts for a while, and then we get disappointed, you get full, and you go to the toilet, and you want more cake, or more this, or more boyfriends, or more handbags, or more clothing, or more bodies. And so now it's so much suffering in our culture, we're not even happy even with what we are born with. And I'm not being critical to anybody. We're dissatisfied with who we are, we're dissatisfied with our friends, we're dissatisfied with our nature, we're dissatisfied with our gender, we're dissatisfied with everything. It's not criticizing anybody. We have this deep suffering of dissatisfaction. We suffer from it terribly. It's real. It's not critical. It's real. It's heartbreaking. And the tragedy is we believe it. We believe it. This is what's so shocking. And even though someone else can say, you're really beautiful, Rabina. You're a nice person, Rabina. You did that really well, Rabina. We don't believe it. We just don't believe it. We just don't believe it. It's kind of very shocking when you think about it. You think that when someone says, you know, I mean, we know this one. If 37 people can say they like you, you're a good person. We don't believe it. One person says you're a creep. We believe it. Now, this is the proof of our own dissatisfaction. It proves the point, isn't it? But you'd think, like, you know, or even, you'd think if someone says you're really nice, oh, am I? Oh, what a relief. No, we don't. And we know what this is like when we have other friends who are always depressed and unhappy. And not being critical about anybody. We're all the same. We know how exhausting it is. We try to point out their good qualities, but they can't see them. You know? We're all the same. So this stuff's not that easy. It sounds easy, but it's very deeply ingrained. So we've got to be very kind to ourselves, very cautious, very humble, very sincere, and very, very clear with ourselves. This is the first level of attachment. So because we're dissatisfied, not content, we then hunger for something more. And then we believe when I get it, that, and then we spend our lives doing that. Always changing object to object, friend to friend, job to job, shape to shape, food to food, never stopping, never stopping. For a while we're satisfied, then we get dissatisfied again. We know this. We recognize it. We recognize it. We are all familiar with this. And this is how we suffer, Buddha says. And then the other aspect, of course, as we've been talking before, the aspect of attachment is that when it doesn't get what it wants, when the cake fills you up, when the boy is mean to you, when you get disappointed, you get disappointed and dissatisfied again. All that turns into anger, dissatisfaction, annoyed, frustrated, depressed. So we go through between these two like 1,000 times a day, you know. Then all the other neuroses come from these, like the jealousy and all this stuff, are on top of these. These are the fundamentals. This is the Buddha's view of why we suffer. And we have the potential to know our minds and slowly reconfigure these assumptions, because they're all conceptual stories. Conceptual stories. So our emotions are underpinned by conceptual stories. The emotions are just the tip of the iceberg. That's all. That's all. When the body's involved, you know. We recognize. Everybody recognizes. This is natural. So, you know, yeah. And it really does take time. So that's where one of our biggest mistakes also is. You hear this, you get all excited, oh, I'm going to try and get more content, you know. And then you think, oh, I'm going to now practice on my mind. I'm going to be a good little Buddhist and I practice. And then a year later, you notice that you're even thinking more angry than you were before. You're even more attached than you were before, and you get really depressed. Well, the first thing is, you're not really more attached than before. You're just noticing it now. But the other thing is, often, as Lama Zopa puts it, when you practice, the dirt has to come out. So one of my friends, who is a serious meditator, Roger, an Australian monk, not Lama Zopa's attendant, another one, who's done serious retreats, 3-year retreats, 4-year retreats, full-on serious meditator, okay? Doing all this stuff. And at some point, he said he was out of his brain with extra levels of rage and arrogance. He was really kind of scared of it. He didn't know what was going on. And he went to Lama Zopa, and Rinpoche laughed and laughed and laughed and said, fantastic, the dirt has to come out. The dirt has to come out. The dirt has to come out. So when we know that, we will interpret more correctly what's going on and won't get too depressed, you know. But that's not easy, because part of the problem is too the irony of attachment. Attachment thinks, I'll get the better cake and I'll be happy. I'll get the new boyfriend, I'll be happy. I'll change my breast size, I'll be happy. And then we think, oh, I'll start to meditate, we'll be happy. And then we fall into the same trap. Oh, I'm still the same. It's a bit like kind of you heard about riding a bike, you've seen Lance Armstrong, you hop on a bike and you fall off again. Oh, I tried to ride a bike, I didn't succeed. Well, a little bit longer, please. So we've got to be in for the long haul. This is not, the way that Buddhism describes the depths, the layers and depths of these neuroses is very, very shocking to us. We don't have such subtlety of understanding of the mind, and that's not being rude to neuroscience, it's just how it is, with respect. So we really got to be for the long haul. I mean, I can, you know, and so you could argue until you really, even though as much as we practice, we do practice, all of us do our best, we practice, you know, try to do our best, live in our vows, practice sowing all the right seeds. So part of the thing is, okay, one thing is we want the satisfaction now. We're hungry for the satisfaction now. But the other thing, but that's just not reasonable. We know perfectly well if you start to be a cyclist, it'll be a long time before you're like Lance Armstrong. But that doesn't mean you can't be satisfied. So we have to learn to be satisfied when we're in grade one. You've just achieved grade one. Fantastic. You'd be satisfied with grade one. But you've got to tell yourself that you did a good job, because automatically, with the dissatisfaction still rampant, you'll think, I'm only in grade one, you know? Oh, no, fantastic, I've achieved grade one. But we've got to say these things consciously, because the default view will just come up, you know, you're not good enough, because it's a long way to go before it disappears. So you've got to delight in each step of the way. That's a really crucial point. But the other point this is indicating is, using the Lance Armstrong example, or you try to grow a garden, you know, if you want to grow an oak tree and a few rose bushes and things, you just can't expect a result tomorrow. But you know that when you're a gardener, so you're prepared to be having the long-term view, and you're not disappointed when you get up tomorrow morning and don't see an oak tree. You know it's foolish, so then you're prepared to wait for the long haul, but you enjoy the process of the growing, don't you? When the little sprouts pop up, you get happy. That's the attitude. It's easy to say these things, but it really is profoundly true. But it won't come naturally, because the default mode of I'm not enough is very strong, so we've got to argue with it. We've got to argue with it every day. Just remind ourselves, I'm doing well. So we've got to practice being content with where we're at. And we can't force it. The unhappy feelings will still be there because there's a long way for them to go, but we've just got to practice and be humble with it. But you could argue very strongly that you won't really feel any genuine contentment until you've got single point of concentration, shamatha, samadhi, you know. And most of us in our lives, being the nature of our lives, won't go to do that, won't go to the mountains and get it. It's only really then, when you've radically shifted your mind, when you've radically controlled all the crazy thoughts, when you're quite an amazing being. Still much more work to do, but until you get to that point, you won't, you can really say your mind will still be uncontrolled. You'll always be running to the default mode of not enough, not enough, but you just get more and more familiar with it, and then you learn to live with all this dissatisfaction, and you know you're doing a good job, you know you're sowing the seeds, and you can anticipate the oak trees coming, so you know you're in for the long haul. That's the way your mind can relax a bit, you know. Are we communicating here? It's the commonest thing I hear all over the world. Oh, I've been practicing for 1 year, 5 years, 10 years, 30 years, and I still get angry, I still get attached, I still get depressed, like as if it's a mistake. No, that is not the mistake. The mistake is that you thought you should be better than you are. And that's the dissatisfaction. That's like getting to be Lance Armstrong and still overwhelmed by dissatisfaction. And that's pretty common, even with the high, you know, the most evolved, greatest musicians and greatest artists, if they're always miserable, because they never learn to be joyful about each step of the way, always dissatisfied, even though objectively they may be the best artist on the planet, and they're getting $50 million a painting, and they still go kill themselves because they're miserable. That's because we haven't worked on our mind. Are we communicating? We recognize, don't we? So it's the hardest job we'll ever do. But just start somewhere. Just start somewhere, one step at a time, and delight in our progress. But you've got to say those words to yourself. We want other people to say what a good job we're doing, even though we don't believe them. We have got to learn to have the courage to say it ourselves. That's when it's very powerful. But we're almost scared to do it. You know, it's very fascinating. We have to learn to do it, you know. So, of course, if you're not riding a bike, then you should be dissatisfied. You can't just say, oh, I'm not like Lance Armstrong every day. You watch him on the telly and you never do anything. Well, you should be satisfied. You should be dissatisfied. You're not doing anything. But as soon as you start trying, you're moving towards it. You've opened the door. Then you should learn to be content with how much you've accomplished. This is quite a profound point, but we have to remember it. It won't come up naturally, I promise. It's up to us, you know. That's contentment. But of course we think contentment is having when the right house, the right garden, the right husband, the right children. But husbands get old and cranky and children grow up and leave you, you're going to be just depressed again. Because you can't set it in stone, we know that. So your mind gets contentment. Doesn't mean you don't have to have a nice, doesn't mean you can't have a nice husband and nice children. Yeah, do. But don't rely upon them to make you feel content. Wrong job. It's not their job. It's your job. When we get that, we really understand it. Then you have the best of both worlds. Okay, questions? Any old question? People? Yes, go for it. Up here. Excuse me.
So, just the obvious thing to me is...
Can you hear him?
Okay. When I think of content, I think, okay, I've reached a point, you know, where it's good enough.
No, that's depressing. Good enough. No, it's not like that. No, that's okay. Rubbish.
That's the definition to me.
Well, then you better change your definition, baby.
You know, so I don't have to go any further. I'm content.
No, that's laziness. That. No, that's passivity and laziness. Contentment is delighting in where you're at as you keep moving forward.
Okay.
Just change your definition. Then it should make you very happy. Is that easy? Right. You can do that?
That was easy.
That was very easy, yes. Okay, next. Who else? Where are you? Anybody? Any old question? Okay, here we are. Over this. Okay, down here first. Then you next. Okay, sure. Down here first, then you next. Over here. Yes, sweetheart.
less a question than a request. I'm interested in hearing about your conversion from Catholicism to
Buddhism.
Buddhism, because I'm trying to explain that to people without coming off like a loon, and it's not going well. But it's these concepts make sense, and they don't require this mysticism that I have always struggled with.
I understand.
And so I understand what you're saying, right? But family and friends are...
No, I know. Well, I think if it's family and friends, you've got to be very cautious. You've got to be very cautious, and don't try to convince them. You've really got to almost go the opposite. Honestly, because people have their own views of what they think Buddhism is, and then you start getting their definitions of it, and you'll think they're in something they're kind of living. It's like an insane idea. People have so many weird ideas about Buddhism. So you really, I've got a feeling, the main advice I've got is don't try to convince them. You be cautious and almost go the opposite. Don't talk about it. And then if they ask questions, I mean, they're probably just trying to be polite, so don't just leap in and start talking for 20 minutes. I really do believe that's true, and I can say that with my own family. I've got 7 siblings, and I've been a Buddhist for 43 years, okay? And I'm close to my siblings. I love my family. I love my family. I had a mother before she died, and my daddy died before I was a Buddhist. I've got 7 siblings, and all my aunties, and I've got cousins and people, and I think I can, with my sisters even, and we're very close to each other, and my brother. I could count on 2 hands the actual conversations I've had in 43 years. Because they've got their own idea. All brought up Catholics, and they all hate the Catholic Church now. And I mean, unfortunately, I mean, it's awful. I wish they didn't, but never mind. But they're good people, all of them good people. All really ethical, really moral people, helping the world, doing good things, you understand? But they just have not the slightest interest in anything that looks like what Buddhism is, even though they might know it's about the mind. I mean, they're all thinkers. They think about things and they take responsibility. They're very accountable in their minds. But they're just not interested. Not interested. So I never, ever tried to have conversations, luckily. I mean, I was like 32 when I first became a Buddhist, and I could see very quickly there's no benefit in trying to say anything. So I just felt it was the proof of the pudding in the end. Me, over the 43 years, they see I'm looking happy and content. They don't quite know why. You know, it must be okay.
That's really important. Related and helpful. I'm also interested in kind of, can you just describe what happened to you when you...
For my
you
process.
From one world
yeah, my view, process, of
one
course.
One worldview to another.
No, well, it was several in between.
Okay.
Now, I mean, I've told people here before, but as you asked me, I'll tell you briefly. I think in my life I was always looking, I didn't put these words to myself, but I was always really wanting a way to see the world. I don't want to sound too grand, you know. I was brought up a Catholic. I mean, since a tiny kid, as soon as I went to Mass, I remember, I might have been about 3, I knew the priest was my job. Not the altar boy, the priest. You understand? I just knew, and I went home and announced I was going to be a priest. I was so happy. I found my life already. I found the purpose of my life when I was 3, you know. I was so excited. And, I mean, they all laughed at me and said, you can't be a priest. You're not a boy. I think I was so young, I couldn't even understand intellectually. So, I mean, then my mother being a Catholic, my father wasn't, and she sent us to a Catholic convent. I was educated for 12 years by the nuns. So in one part of me was in heaven. I was in trouble at school. I was a bit, you know, it wasn't so cool. But I always loved going to Mass. I knew all the Mass in Latin. I was in love with God, thought about the meaning of these things all the time. I really enjoyed that. I didn't have guilt. I never had that guilt business. The nuns were horrible to me. I was a naughty girl. But I still are glad about what I had, the education I got. I'm very pleased. But I'd always think about these things, all the time thinking about the meaning of life and this stuff, you know. And I just thought everybody else thought this way. I didn't have the conversations with my sisters. I didn't notice they didn't think this way. But you understand, it was just my own internal world and reading books and things and reading the saints' lives. But at the same time, I was naughty, rebellious. I was the worst kid possible. So it's kind of a contradiction in a way. Same there. So then I remember vividly when I was 15, at one of our school fairs, have these big fairs on a Saturday, and you come and you buy things, you know, our convent. I remember one of the girls' fathers managed one of the radio stations, so I remember, our mother wouldn't let us even, I mean, that was in the 50s, we weren't allowed to listen to Elvis, because my mother was a classical musician, we only were allowed to listen to classical music, not even rock and roll, you know. So we felt very deprived, of course. But I remember, I saw this 7-inch LP, and it said, Billie Holiday. And I didn't even know who it was. I said, I wonder who he is. But I had sixpence, 5 cents, so I bought it. And I played it. It blew my mind. I didn't know anything about American music. I didn't know about America. I'd heard about America. got history. I don't know about Black American experience, and all I know is that blew my mind and opened me up to a whole world of sort of a whole approach of seeing suffering and drama that I didn't see in my own country, even though it was right next to me staring in my face with the Australian history, but I didn't see it. So that was really the beginning of me moving towards social, more from religious, do you understand? More about the way understanding the world opened me up. It was very amazing. But then by the time I was 19, it took me a while. I decided it was goodbye God, hello boys. And then I became serious hippie, serious sex, drugs, and more jazz, never rock and roll. And then when I was 23, I went to London. My mother tried, I was studying classical singing, and she wanted me to continue to become a singer. She said I had great potential, you know. She hoped. When I got there, it was 1968, so ripe and ready for revolution, you know. So I gave up. It was a conscious decision. I remember, I always agonized. I want to try and be an actress. I want to try and be a musician. I always wanted to be something, but could never find anything that so suited me. So talk about dissatisfaction, but always being kind of sort of so tortured by it, you know. And I never went to university. I didn't want to go to university. I thought it was boring. I had no interest. But I remember when I was 23, I got to London, I made a conscious decision to give up wanting to be anything, which is part of the hippie thing, right? And it was very healthy. I threw out all these bits, threw out all these assumptions, threw out all these views. In other words, I really could see for the first time I had to throw out what my mother wanted, what my father wanted, what the world wanted. And that's a very powerful thought, by the way. I remember I read about a nurse in England ages ago who wrote a book, first had a blog and then wrote a book, The Five Greatest Regrets of the Dying. And she said the greatest regret was that I didn't follow what I really wanted, but I did what I thought other people expected of me. And I think that's our deepest suffering. But so, and it points to our deepest attachment. Forget about sex, drugs, and rock and roll. Our deepest attachment is to being seen as a good boy or a good girl and doing what we're expected to do. So that was for me the release when I went to London away from my family. And I didn't feel dominated by my mother. I always did my own thing. But that gave me the space to really, I realized I had to throw out of my head everything I'd learned to see what the hell I thought myself. And that, I think, is a crucially important thing we all should do. You might put them all right back again, but you've got to own them as yours. So that was a major step in my own process. So then through in that process, I then became this raging hippie, but I was a very serious hippie. Then I became a kind of radical lefty and demonstrating and getting arrested by the police on Fleet Street, you know, and beating up, blah, 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 a serious radical lefty, and then very serious kind of into black politics, and then very serious into feminist politics, always serious. And I was going from these views, looking for the way to see the world. And so I think by the time I was about 31, I kind of exhausted all options. I was joke. I exhausted all options of who to blame for the suffering. First it was all the non-Catholics, and then it was all the straight people, the rich people, and then it was all the white people, then it was all the male people. I had no one left on the planet to blame. I mean, it was like that. Really, I'd exhausted all options of where to look, and then finally I was doing my martial arts, and then I broke my foot and I bumped into Lama Yeshe and Lama Zopa. So it was an evolution, but it wasn't from Catholic to that. It was looking for a view from this side, and that's why, and I mean a view, it's what I found so powerful about the Tibetan Buddhist one, even though the packaging was very arcane, this was in the 70s and there wasn't anything published, I knew there was something there I recognized, so I knew I had to persevere with it, you know. But everyone's different. I mean, people might not like a view. They want a bit of practice. They want a community. We've all got something different. But I wanted a view. So that was very much part of the way I went through my life. Do you understand? I look back on it. It looks very logical. I didn't see the logic at the time. And my poor family didn't see any logic. There's always poor Rabina, you know. Do you understand? She couldn't find a boyfriend, couldn't find a husband, couldn't find... But I knew exactly what I was doing in one way. You understand my point? So you've got to be brave and don't try to convince them. Just be normal. And even crack a joke if they ask you a question and change the subject. Don't fall into the trap of being earnest and answering. Do you understand? Really don't. And don't expect them to. I tell you, that's the biggest danger. Because then you'll just come over as some wacky and they won't want to listen to you at all. Just be normal. Become more normal than normal. I promise. Do you understand? That's the best advice I can give you. And then it's up to them. You understand? Yeah. I mean, my family used to come to my talks. I give talks and things, you know. They give to me. I come to my talks. But they never talk about it to me. So I think that's okay. That's fine. Don't worry about it. I'm happy. I don't need to talk about how I feel. We all have plenty. And that's something interesting, too, by the way, in our family. The last few years, I'd say, we're now all old. That and we, maybe at some point talk about this, the thing about speech, you know. With families, speech can do so much harm, can't it, you know. Once it's out the mouth, you can't take it back. But because we've got this really conscious, unspoken decision this last 20 years, I'd say, between all of us, the seven of us, we do not now talk about each other badly to each other, which is very common among families. You all gossip about each other, and that's very damaging. We never do that, and we never talk about things we disagree with when we're together. It's just because so we've got so much in common, and there's genuine harmony and good feeling between us, even though we've got very different views, but that we've found what's common ground, and that's so important. Okay. Someone, where were you? Back there, yes?
Hey,
yes.
This is pretty simple.
Go.
Basically, my dilemma is, do I want to put in 2 to 3 years to get to that state? What if that...
Which stage, darling?
To a state that's better than I am in now.
Oh, you mean the example of going and getting single point of concentration?
Right, I'm
that's
saying,
just an example, but that's just the first 2 years. You've got another few lifetimes after that.
All right.
That was just one particular
goal.
Right,
that's one point of view. So I view that life is ephemeral, so I don't want to... If I spend 3-4 years and nothing happens...
What do you mean by... Sorry, stop right there, please. What do you mean nothing happens?
Well,
why would you assume that's a possibility?
It could get better.
No, that's foolish. That means you... Sorry. I want to hear the rest of what you have to say, but I want to make something here. We're talking about a serious technique. And if you were following that technique seriously, you would definitely get results. I mean, you don't just go and put all your money into tennis and then play 3 years with Federer and nothing happens. Clearly you didn't choose the right tennis player. So this is a serious technique that if a person who is serious might want to do. But forget that. What's your point?
Well, I agree, but there are sometimes existential problems within the human condition that can be...
What, darling? Existential sounds a very high word for me.
No, like a real, like a disease, for instance. I mean, it's very easy to convince yourself to make the best of it, but at the end of the day...
Darling, you're losing me completely, darling. Have you got a question here?
Well, yeah.
How about your question? Cut to the chase. Ask the question.
I'm afraid that if I put in the time and effort, I'll get angry at myself for wasting time.
Oh, okay. Okay. So that would imply, like I just said before, that you're not confident that you've got a valid method, isn't it?
Exactly.
In anything,
exactly.
Right? So then before you put your time into a valid method, you need to be confident yourself that it's valid. And that's a key point. And that's the answer to the point for you. If you're going to put your time into anything, even if it's not 2 to 3 years intensive anything, you've got to just even... You've got to be confident that it's the right thing. And that's up to every one of us individually. So here we are in a Buddhist center. It's up to each one of us if you want to move forward, not because you feel good or you like the few words. You've got to be very serious in deciding I want to start thinking this way, because it's a whole worldview. So you've got to have confidence, and you're the only one who can do that. So that's the key to success, isn't it?
Yeah, thanks.
Then when you're confident of the method, then you're happy to commit yourself for 10 years because you know you're... And you don't wait for 10 years to discover you didn't work. You'll know from the first moment because you got to go gradual. Isn't it? It's gradual progress. It's not just hippie and mystical.
Baby steps, right?
You understand?
Yes.
Okay, thank you very much. Who else? Down here, the front. Okay, down here first. Yes, sweetheart?
I wanted to go back to the contentment part, and I perfectly understood how you tied it into dukkha to suffering. When the gentleman over there was talking about contentment in terms of good enough.
Yes, that's right.
I was thinking of, in the Metta Sutta, the Buddha talks about being contented and easily satisfied, humble and not conceited. So what about that type
that's
of
what I'm saying.
Contentment?
That's what I'm saying.
That is what you're saying.
What do you think I'm saying if I'm not
because
saying that? So what do you think that's saying? Okay, forget him. What do you think Buddha's saying?
I'm not exactly sure. He mentioned good enough, and that's really what kind of threw me off, because
who's
I don't
it?
Feel about
Buddha?
It. No.
No, I'm talking about you, Buddha. What do you think Buddha's saying? He said something, I said something, and you're quoting Buddha. So what do you think Buddha's saying? What do you think he's meaning by his words? Tell me exactly what you think he's meaning.
You should find happiness in your state.
Huh? I hear you, but what do you mean? Okay, do you think Buddha's... Okay, Buddha's a person who's achieved a certain result, right? Would you agree with that?
Yes.
And that's the reading from his mind of delusions. Do we agree with that?
Yes.
So would you suggest that takes... based on even what you've understood a little bit, that takes quite a while? It's a long-term goal, right?
Right, it's a goal.
So then he has achieved that goal.
Yes.
But there he is saying, be content. So he clearly can't be saying, just be happy with what you've got and be done with it. He can't be saying that, because his whole point is to show us the method that he used to get where he got. But he's talking about being content at each step of the way. It's all I'm saying, the same here. Be content with where you're at. If you've got a grade one, you're happy with grade one. But the fact that you're grade one implies you've got to go to grade two. His view is, oh, I'm happy, I'm good enough in grade one. That's completely passive. That's passive.
Right. But he shouldn't be grasping for grade two.
But clearly not. That's the point I'm saying.
Right. Okay.
That's the point I'm saying. Being content, always being dissatisfied, is the disease of attachment. So being content means not being dissatisfied. But that doesn't mean I'm happy to go to grade two. You see, we conflate wanting to go to grade two with grasping at grade two. So we throw the baby out with the bathwater. And that's the fine point we have to distinguish between. Virtuous states of mind, there's one called aspiration. To aspire for nirvana. To aspire to go to grade two. To aspire to be a better person. That's not attachment. And the biggest point here in Buddhist psychology, which we don't understand in our culture, there's a massive difference between grasping at something and aspiring it with a virtuous thought. But we conflate them. So we just think, oh, well, be content. Sit back and watch your navel.
Okay.
Do you understand?
Yeah, I think I do.
Because you need fierce determination. Even just to get single point of concentration takes a couple of years. You'd have unbelievable determination. You can't imagine the determination you have to use, the fierce effort every single day. That's not attachment. That's intelligence and virtue. There's a difference. Are you with me?
Yeah. Good. What else, people?
Yes.
Yes, I'm trying to think of how to phrase this question.
Where are you?
In the back.
Yes.
So I'm wondering if you have any advice on how to move from kind of a more intellectual...
A tiny bit louder, please.
Okay, can you hear me now?
Yes.
I was wondering if you had any advice on how to move from a more intellectual, conceptual understanding of emptiness to realizing emptiness.
Well, I mean, not just emptiness, but everything, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Would that include the teachings we're talking about right here, for example? Would that also include that? Would
sure.
you like to have a more experiential understanding of these teachings, not just intellectual as well, or...?
Yeah, definitely.
It's the same, isn't it? Whether it's emptiness or any of the teachings, would you agree that's the general point?
Yeah.
So if you want to make a play like Bach, what's your first step?
Just practice.
What, darling?
Practice?
No, be more precise. Be more detailed. What's the first step?
Getting a piano.
What, darling?
Getting a piano.
Yeah, but then what?
Playing the piano, practicing the piano.
No, darling, you've missed a few steps. And these are the crucial steps.
Listening to Bach?
More than that. What would you just listen to Bach? What do? You get a teacher who, and you have to learn the thing. You've got to squeeze your brain. You've got to squeeze your intellect like crazy. You've got to fill your mind with unbelievably complex intellectual thoughts. Do you agree?
Sure.
Well, there you go. Same as emptiness, sweetheart.
Mm-hmm.
So then be delighted with even the intellectual understanding of Bach's music. Be delighted. Don't think, oh, I wish I could just have an experience of Bach's music. But you've got to learn the theories first, and they're so complex. Emptiness is the same. There's no way in the world you can have an experience of emptiness if you can't recognize the object to be negated. And if you don't know what the object to be negated means, that means you don't know what the mind is. If you don't know what the mind is right from the beginning, you can't go anywhere. So you can't possibly have an experience of emptiness until you've learned all the words. And to get to the point where you can begin to search for the inherent I, you've got to know what inherent means. So there's so much theory to be learned first, and then each step of the way of them to be experienced in meditation as much as we can. And it will come definitely. It will come definitely. Take the right steps. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does.
But what I'm also saying is, if we're still only at the intellectual level, be happy with that. Because in a sense, we're dissatisfied. Oh, I wish I had a taste of it. Well, it'll come. Follow the steps that your teachers have given you. Follow the steps that the Buddha's given you. And honey, it will come. But be happy with knowing, even having intellectual understanding. That's pretty stupendous already. I tell you. That's already almost delicious. Do you understand? It is. Having intellectual understanding is delicious.
Mm-hmm.
Do you understand?
Yeah.
What day are we talking about emptiness? Have you got it down, Donna, to do emptiness? I think you might have skipped it. When are we talking about emptiness?
Oh, sorry.
What day? Oh, well, that was, I don't know, too much.
The weekend is keeping calm in turbulent times.
Oh, Jesus. Well, we're going to have to talk about it then. It's not been, I mean, my mood was too much to go into on one, that's like, we did it, it was just nice though to, anyway, never mind. Well, yeah, okay, we'll talk about emptiness then. I think the weekend's the time. Yeah, someone else?
Yeah.
Where?
Right here.
Yes, sweetheart.
Hi.
You look like his brother. You're not his brother, are you? No, you're not.
No, I don't think so.
Okay, go on. I don't think so.
I'm gonna make this quick, but I love this path with all of my heart.
Oh, good.
It has taught me, the two things that has taught me over since 2015 is fairness.
Whoness?
Fairness.
Fairness, well, that's good.
Take accountability
for
my own actions.
Good.
And to avoid extremes.
Oh, that's good. Well done.
Okay.
So then?
So.
Question?
The question is, I'm at a crossroads on my path because I think that just from my experience over the last few years, we are at an all-time high in whatever people are doing around me or in society of not taking accountability, not being
fair. Okay, well, what's your question, darling?
What do I do? Like, I find myself...
What's the option?
I find myself walking away from, like, my family.
I understand.
Because I can't handle these situations.
Yeah, I understand.
Because I don't recognize where these people are coming from anymore.
Okay.
And I'm trying to remain a Buddhist.
I hear. So what are you... So the only time to say I've got a crossroad, you've got to say there are real crossroads. So what are your options? You've got options right now. What are the actual options you've got? Because if you haven't got options, there's no decision to be made.
My options are to keep doing what I'm doing and not harm anybody.
Well, then you keep doing that. So what do you have to make a decision for?
Because I'm getting angry. My anger has been bad because what's going on around me, it keeps coming in my face.
That's right. So then if something, okay, Buddha's simple advice, if we can't handle something in front of us.
You walk away.
You walk away.
Yeah, but it keeps following you.
Well, no, it doesn't. Your anger follows you.
Right.
Because when we've got anger, we'll always find something to be angry with.
Right.
Even if you're sitting in the middle of the bush, perfect with the trees and the sun, perfect, you'll get angry with something. So then you know this. You don't need to have me tell you this.
Right.
So you sort of, in a sense, know the answers yourself. But you find there's reasonable a conducive condition that you can to just keep practicing, sweetheart.
I'm hanging on real tight because, you know.
What, you want to kill somebody lately?
No.
Well, what do you mean then? What do you mean you're hanging real tight?
Because I've had, like, I have to go to therapy now to get rid of some childhood anger, okay?
I know, but that's what the therapist does, take you back to the childhood. That's not the point. None of that's the issue. Right. No, that's not the issue. The anger's the issue.
Yeah.
And how do you describe anger, darling? Being dissatisfied with something, criticizing something, finding fault.
Right.
So, have you tried the Buddhist view, the approach? You said you have.
Yeah.
So that means the first step is just shut your mouth. Have you tried that?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
But does it work?
Huh?
Does it work?
Most of the time.
Well, that's really good. You're doing beautifully. What are you talking about? How about being satisfied with that?
That's the point.
What is the point?
I'm mad at myself for being angry.
Well, then you've got to stop that. That's the next step.
Okay.
You ask me questions, I'm going to answer you very sincerely. I'm going to ask you. You don't have to go back to your childhood to know when you... Because, you mean, the fact is you were born with anger, like me. Join the universe. Lots of us get born with anger. Some of us get jealousy, some attachment, some fear, some anxiety. We've all got one of the diseases. Don't worry about it. It's your habit. Don't get caught up in looking past into your childhood. It won't help you. You're just going to defend yourself for being angry because look what happened to me. Anger... The world's answer is, why am I angry? Also, my father did this to me. Buddha's answer is, because, darling, you must have practiced it. So it's just an old habit, sweetheart. So have a bit of humility. A bit of humility with yourself. And a bit of patience. And know it's an old habit. But know that you are progressing. And to rejoice in your progress. But what you're doing, like I've been saying here, is all you do is keep seeing your anger as if it was the same anger as 3 years ago. No. The dirt's coming out, darling. You've got to reinterpret it. Be cautious. Watch your mouth. At all costs, don't say the words. And then delight in your progress. And this is a view that you have to cultivate, which you haven't got. You're not delighting in your progress. You're thinking you're shocking. You're thinking you're bad. It's a mistaken conception. So what I'm suggesting, and I'm serious, write it down and say to yourself tonight when you do your four opponent powers, and I'm doing really well. And that'll change your mind. I promise you it'll shine a new light on yourself. This is my advice, and it's more easy than you think. I promise.
Thank you.
Can you hear me?
Oh, yeah.
Try it.
Right now?
Yeah, why not?
You want me to do the four opponent powers?
In your own mind, you could even do that, but wait till tonight if you like.
I think I'm doing great. I think what's been going on around me and the fact
But you just said you're angry with yourself for being angry, so you can't say at the same time, I'm also doing great. Which do you think is true?
Well, I think that now that I look at it, you know...
You're doing better than you thought.
I'm doing better than
Thank you. Happy to hear it.
Thank you.
Good.
I just got to believe it.
But you got to start somewhere.
Right.
You've got to fake it till you make it.
Right.
And I'm really serious. I'm really, really serious here. But this is for all of us the same. You got to start with the words. You understand, darling?
Yep.
And then slowly you will believe them. I promise.
Thank you.
And I admire your practice.
Every morning.
Good, darling. Who else? Yes.
Hello. Back
yes,
here.
Sweetheart.
So I have a short question that maybe has a short answer or maybe a long one. How do you tell the fundamental difference between satisfaction and complacency?
When you know your mind. We don't. In the beginning, you see, this is not the way we describe states of mind in our psychological models. We give equal status to attachment, love, all like in a big soup, you know. So when we hear these words, we're even using maybe, you know, from not unclear definitions. Complacency is laziness. It can't be bothered. It's like I'm good enough as I am. Is passivity. Contentment takes time, but and we in the beginning you won't feel content. Don't even pretend. Like we're saying here, you won't feel it. You know, you won't feel content. But you've got to say the words: "I'm doing really well. I've achieved this much. I'm doing really well. I'm going to practice being content." We have to say the words first. Like say the words first: "I'm doing really well with my anger." We don't believe it in the beginning because the habits are very old. So you've got to start with that. So complacency is laziness and can't be bothered. Content means you're doing well with what's happening, but don't even expect to feel it first. It comes slowly. It means arguing with "I'm no good," arguing with dissatisfaction, arguing with "I always want something more." This is profound, deep stuff. All we can do is start somewhere. So if you know the definition first, complacency is can't be bothered, it's laziness, it's attachment to comfort. You know? And that's one of our worst diseases. But contentment is having, okay, you can't afford to say you're content if you haven't done anything to deserve being content. And that means working on your mind. So if you work really hard on not saying those words, "Oh, I did a really good job." That's a moment of contentment if you like, you're practicing it. It's not natural for us to be content because we are only lazy and complacent, or we're always greedy for more. We can't see that there's two extremes. So this is really refined stuff, you know. But at least if we can understand the words first, Buddha's definitions first. This is really, really vital. Do you understand? And slowly, slowly we start to recognize it inside.
Okay, I can't say I understand it, but I'm getting there. And
good,
that helps.
That's it. All we can do is say that.
Thank you.
All we can do is say that. That's right. Yes. Yeah. Who else? Somebody? Nobody? So maybe you can do a little meditation or something. So why don't we just, we'll do this little visualization of, this visualization is just really using your creative imagination. And because Buddha's saying every thought counts, then just having a few positive thoughts is really stupendous. Is having positive thoughts is one way of being content. Having negative thoughts is feeding discontent. Having positive thoughts is feeding contentment. So we'll just do a little meditation of the Buddha Tara. Do a little bit of visualizing, a bit of light coming, a bit of purifying, and a little bit of just relax. And if you don't like what I'm saying, you don't have to do it. You can do something else. Look at your iPhone. So just relax. So there's different qualities of the Buddha. There's all, and a simple way to think about it is they all represent different qualities that we're trying to cultivate. So there's a Buddha that represents compassion. There's a Buddha that represents wisdom. And there's a Buddha, for example, that represents, these are the three qualities of a Buddha, that represents kind of action energy, power, confidence, self-confidence, courage, optimism, the ability to cut through the obstacles and make things happen. And her name is Tara. So we'll keep, if you haven't done this kind of thing before, don't worry about it, just relax. We'll keep it really simple. If you doesn't, you know, just do what you can with it. But it's basically, we're going to spend about 20 minutes having some positive thoughts, basically, visualizing, imagining. And every thought counts to the Buddha. So we visualize in front of us, we imagine in front of us this emanation of the qualities of the Buddha, like perfect qualities, perfect love, perfect wisdom, perfect compassion, all these qualities. And it's manifesting in this form, as you see in all the paintings, which comes from India and Tibet, of course. And so the name is Tara, and she's known as the Liberator. So it's like a female form, if you've seen these pictures, and she's kind of got like a green light body. It's all made of light. It's radiant and totally gorgeous. She's a very beautiful face. But just think of it as a visual image, an image of these qualities. We don't think like this, but just imagine like this, that she represents this confidence and power and courage and optimism. And she's very radiant, very beautiful, green light body, all, you know, these rainbow colored, like her lower legs, you know, left leg drawn in meditation, her right leg out resting on a little multicolored lotus. And if you've got a spiritual teacher, you always think it's their mind manifesting as this Buddha Tara for your benefit, to show you your potential. Think of it like a mirror image of your potential. Be very easygoing about it. I won't describe too much detail about the visualization, but just imagine that energy out there. So now you imagine from her brow, she sends very radiant, radiant beams of white light that penetrate your brow and fill you completely. And first this, you imagine what it does, is completely purify all the rubbish of this body of ours, this like a big lump of stuff plodding through life, all the sickness of the body and the heaviness of the body, and thinking of all the harm we've ever done to any sentient being with our bodies, the ants we've killed, the fish we've killed, the people we've harmed, you know, misusing our bodies when it comes to our, you know, just different ways we've used our bodies to harm others. Think all of this is completely purified by this radiant white light, completely filling us. Think how fantastic. And then she again sends the white light from her brow that enters your brow and fills you completely. And this time fills you with all the marvelous potential of your own body, such that you, anything you do can only be a benefit to others. Imagine having a body like that from the much practice, that we can only benefit whoever sees us. We benefit all the birds, all the creatures, all the ants, all the dogs, all the humans. Whoever experiences us, we can benefit them with our body. Think how amazing. Not harm sentient beings. Only benefit them. How fantastic. Feel full of this marvelous white light, this potential. And then very happily she sends radiant beams of laser light, red light, from her throat that penetrate our throat and fill us completely. And you think it purifies all the nonsense of our speech. I mean, we mightn't go around beating people up and killing too many things, but our speech makes such a mess. The speech that's kind of violent or aggressive or abusive, speech talking about bad things about people behind their backs, criticizing politicians, criticizing people at work, criticizing our family. We love doing all this. You know, our rubbish speech, just rabbiting on about nothing, whether the person wants to hear it or not, we couldn't care. or even speech that's lying, you know, or our speculation or our nonsense speech. You imagine all of this speech that exhausts us, not to mention what it does to others, completely purified by this radiant red light filling us. How amazing. All gone. Imagine. Again, she sends these radiant beams of red light from her throat that enter our throat and fill us completely, and this time fill us with this marvelous potential to whatever words we say are of benefit. Can you imagine this? Positive words, useful words, funny words, kind words, even just saying hello. Whoever hears us will benefit. Can you think of this? The birds, the ants, the dogs, the humans, any sound you utter, imagine, will be of benefit to who hears you. And we think about this. We need good speech in our lives. We want people to understand us. We want people to do our wishes. We want people to get us that thing in the shop. We want people to believe us at work. We know we're so frustrated and hurt sometimes because no one listens to us. So here we imagine we've got perfect speech, the power of speech, effortless, appropriate, useful, beneficial speech. How incredible. Full of this marvelous potential, this red light. And now from her heart, you imagine Buddha Tara sends from her heart chakra in the center of her chest radiant beams of blue light, like the sky, that enter our heart. And you imagine fills us completely. And this time what it does is completely eradicate, instantly, all the nonsense in our minds, the source of all the problem. I mean, our body and speech are just the servants of our mind. They have no light of their own. It feels like they have, because we never discipline them. And that's what causes all the problems. So here, the mind itself, the ego grasping, the root delusion, the one that clings to the ridiculous nonsense me, the attachment to get what that me wants, the aversion when we don't get what we want, and all the other dramas. All of this stuff, immediately, instantly, annihilated. Imagine that. By this blissful blue light filling us. And again, the blue light comes, and this time filling us with our natural potential for all the other qualities that are at the core of our being. Our natural capacity for utter contentment, fulfillment, joy, clarity, self-confidence, kindness, love, empathy, compassion. Think of this, these qualities. These are who we really are. These are our true nature, and they're polluted by the other rubbish, dragged down by the other rubbish, you know. So imagine our natural state manifesting. And it happens to be in the nature of bliss. And don't take those words lightly. It's literally true. Joyful, fulfilled, content, full of wisdom, all these qualities, our own natural state, full of this blissful blue light filling us. When you now imagine just the lotus that Tara is resting on, it just dissolves into her body. And you imagine she just comes to sit above our crowns, facing the same way as us. Just imagine that. And then she imagines she just dissolves into green light. And imagine the energy of Tara's body, speech, and mind, the energy of your spiritual teacher's body, speech, and mind, and your own body, speech, and mind. The energy of these just completely merge, becoming oneness. And then just about 1 minute, you imagine expanding your consciousness, vast, clear, radiant, blissful. Imagine this. Just imagine this. And try and have no thoughts. For about 1 minute, imagine this. No thoughts. And relax. That's it. 15 minutes. A few positive thoughts. Every thought counts, Buddha says. No thoughts go astray. And that's another reason to rejoice. We're sowing seeds. Every thought you have is like sowing a seed. And when you're doing that garden, the garden might look like a mess, but you know you're sowing seeds. You know you're pulling out the weeds. And you have a long-term view. That's being content. Being content with your progress. Not just content with having a boring old garden, but being content within the fact that you're sowing the seeds. And that's a really good way to say what you're doing as a Buddhist. You're sowing seeds, and the fruits will come. Don't be content if you're not sowing any seeds. That's the laziness. That's the complacency. Oh, the garden's good enough. Look at it. That'll do. I'll be content. That's disgraceful. That's not contentment. That's bone laziness. But you're growing a beautiful garden. Be content each step of the way. That's very different. But like you said, not grasping at it. Are we communicating, people? But we're so caught up with our feelings, we can't see past our own nose. That's our problem. And we have to get past that. And delight in our progress. Delight in our good qualities. So that's it. Good night. Okay. Okay, that'll do. Okay. We'll talk about emptiness. I'm sure we'll have to wait for the weekend for emptiness, I think. Then we can get into it properly.